Hello and welcome to Couch Potato Theater. I am one of your hosts, Davis Grayson. Tonight is so special that we are pulling a world's finest tonight. What I mean by that, we are gathering nearly every voice of the Phantom Podcast Network to do this one special podcast. So, I'd like to introduce to you the other three members of this podcast. Norman, take it away.
Hello, everyone on the Phantom Podcast Network. It is a great honor to be here, finally, actually, on Couch Potato Theater. My goal for this evening for everyone is to become the second to the last Starfighter. I don't want to be the last. I want to be the second to last.
And Kyle.
Hey, it is the last Starfighter. I don't want to be the last either. But I did figure something out over the weekend. The C in Norman C. Lau is for Centauri.
I knew it.
My research and discovered that there were some Excalibur things involved like that, and it involved trading gun stars. It was a real pain to find that top secret information, Norman.
It's still top secret. I'd never cop to that, so I'm just saying. But the conclusion is logical at best.
And surely, but certainly not least, we have one more voice you heard just laughing. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
I am Kevin Reitzel, one of the co-founders of the Phantom Podcast Network, and Norman C. Centauri Lau's co-host on Blood of Kings. And I am the second to last Starfighter's handler. The one that holds the helmet. I hold the helmet for him. That's what I do.
Interstellar. Interstellar.
Actually, I should just say now that I'm actually not Kyle. I'm a beta unit. So.
All right. So as you can tell, we are talking about the last Starfighter, which has made an impact on each of these four gentlemen's lives, which is including me, of course. And, you know, when was the first time you ever heard about that? Kevin, go first.
I actually saw it in the theater when it came out because it was getting some attention for the effects, like Tron was with their computers, and that was something that I thought was really cool, even though I didn't really know a lot about computers. I did pick up a Commodore 64, which I still own, by the way. But that was one of the things that drew me to, and I did see it. And then it took me a long time after that. I didn't see it on VHS until, like, I think the 90s, and I kind of fell in love with it again. And then I think I lost that VHS or it broke or something, and eventually ended up catching it on DVD in the 2000s, and I still have my DVD copy. I didn't upgrade to a Blu-ray. I kept the DVD. There's just something about it that I just think it's kind of cool. I like the original packaging for it, but that's my history with Starfighter.
Kyle, what about you?
I'm like Kevin. I saw it in the theaters when it first came out. One of the big things I remember was the hype for this movie, is like Kevin said, was the use of computers in there. It was a little after Tron, if I'm remembering correctly, but I had seen a special, I think it was on maybe even been HBO at the time, talking about how revolutionary the effects were when Starfighter was coming out. And they went into a great deal showing a lot of the computer graphics, especially with the gun starship. And I mean, this movie at the time, that was a must see in the theater. And I remember going to see it at the theater and just thoroughly enjoying myself. And to this day, it's one of those great movies I can pop in at any time, or if it happens to be in a cable run and it comes on, if it just stays on the TV and I just sit back and enjoy it.
I hear you on that. Norm, how about you?
You know, we're all part of that arcade culture generation. So I think we're like somewhere in our early teens when this came out in 1984.
Oh, yeah.
It was for me. So one of the big draws for this movie is that when you saw this in a preview, you actually saw an actual arcade game that simulated like what is supposed to be the plot of this movie. So everyone kind of gravitated towards that. Unfortunately, we actually never saw an actual stand-up coin-op box for that, which is a crime against humanity and the Star League.
But
well, at the time, we'll get to that. But no, I saw it in the theater, just like, you know, much like everyone else. And I think one of the great things about The Last Starfighter is that it started to fill that void post Return of the Jedi, where we were trying to find properties that were like the successors of Star Wars, very much like, you know, after Lord of the Rings, you know, what's happening with the fantasy genre post Lord of the Rings. You know, you had your, obviously your Harry Potter was really successful. Then you had a lot of, you know, fantasy spin-off type young adult books. But after Star Wars, there were a lot of properties grasping at straws to see who's going to be the next Star Wars. And Last Starfighter just had that kind of Luke Skywalker staring off into the sunset to try and find his destiny kind of feeling, right? With Alex Rogan, like, I want to do something greater than this. I want to be something better than where I'm at right now. And never his mind on where he was.
Hmm? What he was doing. Hmm?
So that was a terrible Yoda. My Yoda's terrible. But I think that was really resonating with a lot of us at the time. You know, we were teenagers. We were trying to find ourselves. We were trying to understand, like, our place, not only in our fandom, but, like, how does all of this make sense to us? And how does this become really inclusive for all of us with our pockets of kind of, like, geek friends that were also watching it? So it was a positive film. It was very uplifting. It made you feel good when you left and you wanted to see it again. And yes, we all have the different iterations of that VHS, DVD, Blu-ray. But the reason why we're doing this, Davis, the reason why we're here on Couch Potato Theater is because this is that kind of movie where you're flipping through channels, whether it's TNT or TBS or, you know, on regular broadcast. And you just don't even get up when the commercials pop on. You know, you don't worry about going, it's like, well, you know what? I have a Blu-ray version of this. I'm going to stick this on instead. No, you're comfortable with watching this just sitting there or lounging or just completely being a lazebo on the couch and just saying, hey, you know what? I love this movie. I'm going to watch it. I don't care if I have a high-res DVD Blu-ray version of this. This movie's too awesome to just even worry about that.
Well, who can argue with that? I have to say, I'm probably the only one who never saw it in the theater.
You're fired.
Well, we need to rethink this whole hosting situation.
You didn't check this guy's resume?
Wait a minute here. Hang on. No. No, I actually remember seeing it on Showtime. And I think it was the Showtime or HBO. And
what year was this?
2015.
Now, it was about a year after the movie had been released, because I remember 1983, Return of the Jedi was in full swing. 1984, you know, Star Wars was kind of slowing down. So, you know, what was next? What was going to be the next big movie? And
I can't believe you saw it on HBO or whatever it was, like a year after, because my family was still rocking the black and white television with the antenna ears at that time.
Well, I mean, I think we got Showtime for real free or something like that. So I got to watch A New Hope like 100 times in 1 month. And, you know, The Last Starfighter was also on there at that time, too. So, I mean, but it's one of those movies that, as Norm said, it's one of those that's eye-catching. You have to watch it, you know, if you're just flipping the channels and if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and it's on, you're going to watch the rest of that movie and see what it's all about.
Well, one of the things, too, I got to bring up real quick, too, is there's a lot of those effects that still hold up well to this day.
I think so. I mean, if you really want to, like, get past the whole, I'm going to be elitist about this, and it's like, there's no way that this thing can hold up to, like, the J.J. Abrams kind of special effects. Yeah, okay, I get that. You can make that argument. But for me, and I think for all of us here, it's not really about the effects. The effects only are there to help the story. If the story's not there, the effects don't matter. Or else you get Avatar. Yeah, I said that out loud.
So, what Norm actually
shock
means
and awe, shock and awe.
I'm just saying. Oh, I think Kevin and I are going to have an offline conversation about that.
Yes, we are.
The next Potato Theater, ladies and gentlemen, Avatar, hosted by Norman C. Lau.
Yeah. That'll be an all-time recording length of 0.00 seconds.
Yeah, we're going to have a arena type duel on that one.
So but in 1984, Grayson, I'm sorry, Davis. I keep calling you Grayson because it just sounds cool. So in 1984, the movie came out. This is the summer, like the height of the summer in 1984. And do you guys remember what else was going on in 1984 at the time? This isn't a quiz. This isn't like a pop quiz. I don't want to put you on the spot, but it was one of those banner years for us. And we are going to be covering a lot of that 1986 kind of flavor in Phantom Flashback. But 1984 is like one of those pinnacle years in films, you know, especially with obviously our love for this. I mean, we were all kind of like pseudo early teenagers at the time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was 13.
Well, it's a bit younger.
Yeah. I was about right about 9, 10 at the time.
Youngins.
So, but now let me ask you all you guys this, because I do think this was kind of one of those first movies after Star Wars that, and Davis brought up this point earlier, when things were like, okay, we got to get the last bit of juice out of the Star Wars feeling that everybody has. And I also feel like there's aspects of this movie that really set up a lot of those similar type movies in the 80s going forward. They took a lot of aspects from this film. What do you guys think of that?
I kind of feel that there was a lot of the normal kid experiencing the extraordinary events, whether you had E.T., you know, or a lot of these other films that were coming. You had Karate Kid. You know, the first one was coming out, and Back to the Future, and all these films that were, you know, sci-fi was definitely kind of making a niche during this time. And you're right, it was, people wanted to ride the wave of, you know, of Star Wars. But there was a lot of really good original stories that were coming out, and this was one of them. And like Norm said earlier, myself, I was huge and entrenched in the video arcade time. I was going down to the arcade and playing all of these games, playing Tron and Pac-Man, and this was a lifestyle. This was a thing that you did, and it was a movie that was capitalizing on that type of pop culture, and everyone was doing it, and that grabbed everyone's attention and imagination.
You know, kind of spoilerish alert, if you haven't like read Ready Player One, you might want to put pause on this for a second, but Ernst Klein, you know, the author of Ready Player One, he uses a very, I guess, the probably most influential catchphrase in this movie, you know, is like a greeting starfighter. You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zur and the Codan Armada. That's actually a fairly decent plot point in Ready Player One. It doesn't hit that status unless a movie like this has become so deeply entrenched in 80s pop culture.
I completely agree, because I mean, not only what everyone's talking about that riding on the waves of Star Wars and everything, but it's a coming of age story. And as you all know, that we are around the same age. So every movie, like you said, Karate Kid, E.T., Back to the Future, eventually, it's all centered around basically a guy. And it's a coming of age showing that, you know, where he belongs in society or where he belongs in his life to make that jump. Because if he never does it, he never makes something of himself.
Yeah, it's also interesting, too, because during this time and all these movies of fantasy and sci-fi, kids these ages were just wanting to know what else was out there. We were learning about other planets and space and you know, space shuttles and space race and all of these things. And so this was the type of movie that just captured the essence of that and just took you on a wonderful ride, which still, in a way, for me, makes it timeless. And I know you, Norm, I know that you can sit in and just enjoy this movie every time you watch it, whether it's on Blu-ray, DVD, or on broadcast television.
Well, there's one thing that's really powerful about the movie genres that we talk about, whether it was Transformers, the 30th anniversary in Couch Potato 1, or Megaforce in Couch Potato 2. What these movies do for us is that it unlocks that really almost primal connection that we had to our pop culture in the 80s. And to be honest, it's no secret that the four of us, when we created this particular show, we wanted to be able to talk about films that influenced us. Now, I think that's great that if somebody actually, you know, younger, say within their 20s, you know, 24, 5 years past what we're talking about, they can find some value in this, because what The Last Starfighter really is, it's a really good story about coming of age and about finding one's true destiny and that moment when you have to make the decision whether or not this is going to be your path. It's very similar to what happened with Luke Skywalker when he chose the path of his destiny, what Obi-Wan wanted him to be, or any hero type character. You know, Joseph Campbell always talks about, you know, the mythology of the hero, and there's the hero's, you know, his path from understanding who he is to battling the forces of darkness, emerging out into the light of the other side. Alex Rogan, actually, he experiences that almost very literally, and we can get to that later on in the plot. But one of the things I think that's really resonating about this movie, especially to young, very young, impressionable teenage young men, is that we're trying to find our place in the universe. We're trying to find our place in society and in our groups. And there's a great analog here for that. Like, we have to make that choice. When are we going to do that? When are we going to make that step forward and not just dream about what we want to become, but actually take that jump into what we want to become?
Kind of like taking it by the horns, right?
That's right. Taking that leap of faith, kind of like, you know, what Indiana Jones did in The Last Crusade, and put your hand over your heart and just kind of step forward. And hopefully that CGI rock bridge to the other side is going to catch you. But it's like, you know, for anyone who's out there who's like our age, you know, men our age, or even maybe some women that are our age who are trying to find their center of the universe, that's what this story is all about. As a matter of fact, it could work with a young man or a young woman, the story, because it's all about trying to find who you are. And are you really supposed to embrace this destiny?
I want to mention real quick, I'm sorry, Kyle, but I want to mention that the one thing about this film that rings true to me is you got a kid living in a trailer park. And the one thing that this movie speaks to is all of those kids that may live in an area of blue collar, people that aren't rich, that have to live day by day. They have families that maybe are working double shifts and such. And this really kind of rang true for a lot of kids that were watching this, because they weren't living the privileged life. And Alex Rogan's character is faced with being stuck in a rut of whether or not he's going to be able to go to the college that he wants. And so, and that's a fear. It's a reality fear pill that everyone is sometimes forced to swallow. And this was a nice, wonderful escape for those that probably were in that and didn't quite find their way just yet, and maybe inspired them too. Sorry, Kyle, go ahead.
Well, no, you brought up a good point that I was thinking of along those lines, Kevin. And, you know, I think especially for the time this came out, when we look at a lot of the movies, especially the science fiction films that came out around this time, they all had kind of that feel good uplift to them. You know, you brought up E.T., something like that, you know, where it you get to embrace your sense of wonder and imagination in a very positive way. And, one of the things that I personally loved about The Last Starfighter too was not only did you have, you know, this story of this young man who's trying to get out of trailer park, move on to the next step of his life, but what's amazing about it is you look back at this now and you look at it, this young man who's thrown into another universe, and just how quickly he adapts to it. You know, he's literally getting in a car out in space, and after some initial shock, he goes in and just, you know, he's accepting of an alien co-pilot, of being on an alien planet without, and he just rolls with it. And you know, that's something that I think doesn't get, they kind of play it up now. Everything is this shock and horror aspect in a lot of these movies anymore. You don't see that kind of natural sense of wonderment like that this movie had. And a couple other examples I can think of, obviously E.T., Flight of the Navigator was another movie that kind of, you got that sense of wonderment from. And I think that's one of the things I've always loved about this film, was you have that, just that sense of wonderment. And like you said, Kevin, you kind of always hope this could be me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. Because, you know, I was taken aback a little bit. I was one of those guys that got turned down for a student loan, or I was denied the opportunity to go away to college. Now, I think it was actually probably one of the best things for me, because I got to do other things. But I see where he was coming from, going, well, what else am I going to actually be able to do with my life, so to speak? So, and you have to look at it. You know, if you look at The Last Starfighter, if you look at Flight of the Navigator, anything of that sort, you watch it and you have to wonder, you want to know, like in my own opinion, it looks like you want to know the myth and the mysteries to everything. It was a good world building movie, so to speak, because you wanted to know who the Kodan Armada was. You want to know who built the frontier. You know, why was this built? You know, why is the Star League so important? I mean, and to have that much and him say, I can't do this. And to him actually leaving, that actually was one of the best things he could have done. It was his favorite mistake, so to speak. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on. So the budget for this movie was $15 million. So
deal.
And it got a Rotten Tomatoes of a 76 fresh rating. So not too shabby, I would say.
That's better than Batman versus Superman.
is that like a current rating? Because that was Rotten Tomatoes around back then? I don't know if it was.
I don't think it was.
But that is a current. I mean, that's a, definitely a current rating.
But it's definitely after the fact.
Might have been around another. After the fact. So
yeah.
The box office gross was $28 million, and opening weekend did $6 million.
You know, I would love to know what I know now. Sorry, Davis, but I'd love to know what I know now about is that profitable compared to like what studios expect now? I mean, like let's take Star Trek Beyond, for example. They spent like over $150 million. So it's almost like $185 million in terms of the overall production budget. You know, and I'm not sure how much is grossed right now, but we've all heard stories about like if you don't triple gross, the production cost, then it's considered financially unsuccessful. So for something like this, is this something that the studios are like, well, it was only, you know, $15 million? We almost doubled that.
That was probably a good amount of money to make back, because nowadays when you throw in the production value, sometimes, not always, the marketing budget is put in there as well. And some movies nowadays will spend $100 million on marketing alone.
That's true.
But yeah, you're right. There's about, you know, you have to kind of triple your budget there. But back then, marketing is what it is now. So, you know, they probably maybe spent less than $100,000 on marketing. You know, they probably, you know, put posters out there. They obviously had trailer, paid for TV spots and maybe, you know, trailers in movie theaters and such. But yeah, I think that was probably making $6 million opening weekend on a $15 million budget. I think that's a great take for that.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, I will have to agree.
I will say this, Kevin. I remember this movie actually being fairly heavily marketed, especially in the print media, because I can tell you, if I go back into my boxes of comics, I have a lot of comic books with an advertisement for The Last Starfighter on it.
Yeah. I think some of those hit my G.I. Joes as well.
That was Marvel Comics adaptation, right? It was under Marvel?
Yeah, yes, Marvel did the adaptation. So yeah, Marvel pushed it big time.
Absolutely. So I know we have already been talking about the plot, and we've talked about a little bit of a coming-of-age story and everything, but let me go ahead and just read the plot description to make sure all the fans know exactly what we're talking about. So Alex Rogan lives in a trailer court where his mother is a manager and everyone is like a big extended family. He beats the Starfighter game to the applause of everyone in the court, and later that day finds he's turned down for a student loan for college. Depressed, he meets Centauri, who introduces himself as a person for the company that made the game. Before Alex knows what is going on, he's on the ride in the car flying through space, chosen to take the skills he showed on the video game into real combat to protect the galaxy from an invasion. Alex gets as far as the Starfighter base before he really realizes that he was conscripted and requests to be taken back home. When he gets back home, he finds a Zandozan. An alien bounty hunter is stalking him. Unable to go home and live, Alex returns to the Starfighter base to find all the pilots have been killed, and he is the galaxy's only chance to be saved from invasion. To defeat the invaders who are paying the bounty on him, he must be victorious.
I love that so much.
Oh, that is so good.
I mean, isn't that just a great plot story? I mean, are you excited to see this movie now?
Oh, God. Well, who wouldn't want to be playing a video game and then you find out it's an audition for a real life event? I mean, I had many Pac-Man dreams that might happen one day.
Yeah. Eating ghosts and eating power pellets and powering up.
Or Tron, one of my favorites as well. And Donkey Kong. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I got to ask you, though, real quick. Did you guys wish that there was a video game at the time?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Now I have to say something with this film. This is one of those films that had so much marketing potential between video games, toys, and other things that they never tapped that could have made this movie stand out even more and probably gotten to produce more sequels.
Yeah.
For this film. So I think that when I think of a movie that just really untapped, untapped potential in it. The Last Starfighter is definitely one of those films.
You know, it's funny when you actually look at the culture of the time and the way that movies are marketed, especially to a certain genre and audience. Obviously, Star Wars had the model for being able to take, at every level, being able to take their product and create certain strata of what they needed to hit, whether it's coloring books, action figures, costumes, soundtracks, even 8mm reel-to-reel movies, which actually had one, and just be able to tap into all of those different types of production lanes, if you will. But I think that sometimes movies like this, as successful as they were, I don't think that they were actually thinking that far ahead. I think that when they actually made the movie, like, wow, this is a great movie. But if there was one thing that I agree, Kyle, if there's one thing that they really kind of missed the boat on, it's the fact that they actually based the central plot point of this movie as the video game and never created something that would extend to the zeitgeist of pop culture at the time, which was the arcade genre, which is essentially why this movie was so successful, is because all of us lived in the arcade. When I used to go to Belden Village Mall in Canton, Ohio, my mom and dad said, we're going to go shopping, and they gave me $5 to stay in Aladdin's Castle, which is also referenced in Ready Player One because our heroes are from Ohio. I went to Aladdin's Castle, and they said, make this last for 2 hours, and you did. But the thing is that it doesn't matter how long you played the games. It was the fact that you were in there to begin with, and you knew the players there, and you had friends there. It was like this mini summer camp inside the arcade. So why they didn't make a Starfighter game to tie into this game or tie into this movie was actually probably one of the bigger mistakes, I think, in marketing.
Kyle, you had something to say?
Well, no, I agree. I agree completely with Norman. And, you know, I think you get Starfighter out today. We have a PS4 game. We have an Xbox One version of it. We have got some incredible toys coming out. So it's one of those movies that I think, even if it would have come out 3 years later when the toy marketing was really big in the 80s, who knows what we might have seen at that point. You know, we would have probably seen an Atari game. We would have probably seen Hasbro or Kenner or somebody make a Gunstar.
Yeah, I know. Gosh, so many things can change too. I mean, at this time too, there wasn't the automatics. A lot of filmmakers weren't looking ahead to, hey, we're going to make this film. Let's also look ahead and for a possible sequel after that. You know, they're not signing. A lot of the actors that are signed for these films weren't being signed for multiple picture deals. There was a few that were done out there, of course, but a lot of them weren't. And so, you know, like, you know, you guys alluded to, they probably lost a lot of revenue on marketing alone with toys. And God, we would love to have seen those toys, wouldn't we? Those action figures. Oh, man. Well,
yeah, I mean, that's where you go into the whole, like, Burger King, the glasses that you collected or the Happy Meals. I mean, okay, so one thing, people, that you really need to know, all of our listeners here at Cal's Potato Theater, is that we all have our levels of expertise. Davis is an expert at action figures and genres of the 1980s. So we talked about this, Davis, when we were hanging out having dinner in Orlando. In Disneyland. And one of the things that you said about the Last Starfighter's action figure line is that they were planning on it, but they never made a Gunstar. And that was something that sunk that line, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, I don't know, a lot of people know about this, but toy fairs back in the 80s, they actually did a lot of different, even in the 90s, they did a lot of different lines. And sometimes they would get produced and other times they would not. For example, there was one Western toy line that came out in 1999, never did happen. They had like the stagecoach, the horsemen and everything right there, but it never did happen. Same with the Last Starfighter. There was figures of Zur, there was figures of one of the pilots, but there was no Gunstar mentioned. When I did my research just to try to find like which action figures would be available or what could be done, and there was never a Gunstar. And can you imagine how cool that would have been to have a two-seater Gunstar, to have your own Grig and Alex to be right there with you?
Well, like going back to G.I. Joe, I mean, that's kind of like releasing the Sky Striker without Ace, right? I mean, it's like, why would you do that?
Oh, no, don't even do that.
That's what I'm saying. You know, that's what I'm saying.
You're just traumatized, Kevin.
God, I see your point, though. And it's also one of those things I love to do with toys back in the day was was mix my figures and toys. I would have loved to have put, you know, Shipwreck inside that Gunstar, or, you know, taken Alex Rogan and put him in a Mobat tank and stuff like that. So there was just this family of toys that toy line would have fit right in.
Davis, who was producing the prototypes of those?
From what I remember, it was not Kenner, or it wasn't, let's see.
Was it Galoob?
I want to say it was Galoob. Galoob.
Galoob usually got kind of like everything else that wasn't caught by either Hasbro or Kenner or Mattel at the time, right?
Yeah, Galoob got a lot of the secondary movie licenses, if I remember correctly.
And if you remember, in 1987, they got the Star Trek Next Generation line.
That's right. Yep.
Yes.
And so, I mean, they released one big wave, and they were supposed to release a second wave, and it just never happened. They were supposed to have play sets, and that never even came to being. The only thing that was released was the Bridge Crew, Q, two aliens, a shuttlecraft, and a Ferengi Marauder.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
So, gentlemen, one of the things I found always interesting about The Last Starfighter was it kind of had an interesting cast to it, because to me, at the time and even afterwards, there's a lot of the actors that were in The Last Starfighter who I felt like I didn't see that much of after The Last Starfighter.
Well, that was almost like, you know, in the 80s, it was kind of like a one-hit wonder kind of thing. You know, it's and that's also what I think is really endearing about some 80s movies, is that you saw some of these actors or actresses and you didn't see them since. And all of a sudden they become kind of like, to coin a Doctor Who phrase, they become time locked, you know, in that particular movie. Yeah. So you always go back. It's like, oh, well, you know, I haven't seen Barry Bostwick since Megaforce. And then all of a sudden I see him on Spin City and you're like, what happened, Ace? You know, but it's true. The 80s were... What I love about 80s everything is that 80s, they tried so hard just to do something, to make any kind of entertainment. And if it worked or if it didn't work, it still worked for somebody. So I agree with the cast, but let's kind of let go down the line. Davis, who do we have first in talking about the cast?
Well, the first person we want to talk about is none other than the Music Man himself, Robert Preston. Ooh. Which, in case anyone knows, that this was his final movie.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Centauri himself. Yep.
And, you know, I got to say, when I first saw it, I was going, this man looks so familiar. I feel like I want to sing a song about this.
We've got trouble. All kinds of trouble. With a capital T, and that rhymes with Z, and that stands for Zur.
Well, and I've got to say, well, I think they were trying to make the Centauri character kind of maybe a little bit of the comedy of this film as well. I really do think the Centauri character was kind of the soul of this film.
Agreed.
Oh, I believe he was the Obi-Wan of this film.
Agreed. Robert Preston really kind of commanded every scene that he was in.
Absolutely. And, you know, you could almost wonder if I had heard rumors, and you could tell me if this is true or not, but I had heard rumors that he was actually sick during this time of filming.
And I've heard those same rumors.
Yeah. So, I mean, he played it really well. And if he was actually really sick, he was still doing an awesome job, still having that command presence about him.
I think that falls in the same line of the way that they approach the Star Wars films, because, you know, and we're all Star Wars fans, and some of us, we have experts in the room. But, you know, when they cast Star Wars, they needed some anchors. You know, they needed some legitimate acting anchors to anchor the film itself, to be able to sell it to investors and to be able to get, you know, a lot of people to come in and say, like, okay, this is a serious film. This isn't just kind of like a whim of a film. So Star Wars had Alec Guinness and it had Peter Cushing. You know, those were heavy bankable actors in British cinema. So now you have Robert Preston, the Music Man. You know, he is heavily steeped into at least the Disney audience. So now you have that audience. And you know, when you see Robert Preston, you're going to have a certain kind of safe environment, if you will. You know, he has a pedigree of not being one of those actors who has a lot of drama attached to him. You know what you're going to get out of a Robert Preston performance. But I think without him, a lot of the movie collapses, because he's so pivotal to the actual spiritual superstructure of this film. Without him as Centauri, it almost seems not to work, because it's not just that you have this wise man, but he's Obi-Wan and Yoda at the same time. He was Yoda at first, like, come here, my boy, come here. You know, come and step into this car and I'll show you what this is all about. You know, he's the slick car salesman. But when push comes to shove and he really needed to impart the wisdom on Alex, that's where Yoda comes in. And he has a really nice balance between the two. He's the sage. He's the wise man that gets the journey started, you know, in the quest architecture of this story.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know, with moving right along to the next one, Lance Guest, who played Alex, I think Kevin has a great story to share.
Ah, yes. Lance Guest. I want to mention real quick that a lot of actors, they were trying to find the next big face that could maybe, you know, become the big star. And it says here in the trivia that Lance Guest was cast because he had the qualities of James Stewart and Henry Fonda. And I've seen a lot of old films with these actors, and I can totally see that. And I'm kind of surprised that Lance Guest hasn't gone on to do a lot bigger stuff because, you know, he's a good actor and he's a very nice guy. What Davis is referring to is I had a chance to meet him recently in June here in the Atlanta area, which is where I am recording from. There is a wonderful convention. It's a few years old now, called the Southern Fried Video Game Convention. And what it does is it celebrates old video games. They do have some new ones, but they specialize in the old stand-up arcade. They also specialize in pinball games, and they also showcase like every single home console game that you could think of that has been made. And there's a room that you could go into, and it's kind of dimly lit, so you can see all of the television screens that they had to still save from those times to actually play these game systems. But one of the things that they did was they had Lance Guest as their featured guest, and he was signing autographs and he was talking with people. And I had to meet this guy because a certain good friend of mine, Norman C. Centauri Lau, is a huge Last Starfighter fan. So I'm like, you know what? I have an opportunity here. So I introduced myself from the Fandom Podcast Network, and I said, look, you know, I'm a fan of yours, but you know what? One of my very good friends is a much bigger fan of this movie. And so I had the opportunity to get a couple of things autographed for Norman. I think it was a 8x10 and a Blu-ray one. But what's really funny, he was very cool. We talked. I had my Oakland Raiders hat on. We talked a little bit of football as well, and talked about him. And he's just kind of doing the family thing now, raising his kids, and working on some other projects. But what was funny was they had a dealer room that didn't have a lot of dealers in there. But I went in there, and this guy had all these great retro VHS movies. He had he had Laserdisc collections, and even had some Betamax. But I was walking in there after I got the initial autographs for Norman. I was walking in there, and they had a Laserdisc, still sealed, Last Starfighter Laserdisc in there. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
Only one?
Only one. It was in the collection of Laserdiscs this guy was selling. And so I bought it. I opened up the side seal because I wanted to eventually play it, and I took it out and went back to Lance. I said, hey man, look what I found. He's like, is that an album? I'm like, no dude, this is a Laserdisc. He's like, that is so cool. So I had him sign that for me, and but I just wanted to say it was a pleasure to finally meet this guy, and it was also nice to do something nice for Norman, because he'd been just awesome for the Fandom Podcast Network and Bloody Kings, and I just knew it was something that he would do. But on a side note, I got to mention, they had a real working Starfighter video game.
And how many times did you play it?
I played it once because I found out I was not worthy. I could not get the controls down to save my life. But I took some pictures of it, and I sent those to Norm. And then I went and played Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. and a bunch of other games that I was good at. But it was fun to play it. Someone had it working and made this mock-up of the game. And It was just, it was a unique experience to be at a convention like this that celebrated these old arcade style games. And also they were promoting new games that were coming out arcade style and new pinball games. So it was a great convention. And I think I surprised Norm. It was nice.
Now this was the Rogue Synapse game. Yes.
They were. Are you talking about the Starfighter game?
Yeah, because there's an actual group out there or a company out there that's called Rogue Synapse. And they created the cabinet, and they re-simulated the entire program, you know, for that.
I believe it was. I think that was their name, but I'm not 100% sure. I was kind of taken aback by the thing that actually was working.
Oh, God. I would kill to play that game. Jesus.
But yeah, it was a thing, and I wanted to share that on this special here because you know I Lance Guest doesn't do a lot of conventions. And it was nice that he came out, and he was a gentleman.
Now, speaking of Lance Guest, I just want to throw in another story. Is I actually got a chance to see him several years ago in a Broadway musical, an off-Broadway musical called The Million Dollar Photo. And Million Dollar Photo was a story about the one time at Sun Records, and this is the record studio that produced Elvis Presley and a lot of the legendary artists at the time. So Elvis Presley.
Yeah, out of Memphis,
you're right. Elvis Presley. Roy Orbison, let's see, who else was there? Jerry Lee Lewis and, a country singer. I can't remember his name. But anyway, there were four legendary artists at the time. Who did the original Blue Suede shoes?
Oh, Carl Perkins.
Carl Perkins, that was it. Carl Perkins was the fourth. Well done, Kevin. And they all took a picture together that one night. They were all just hanging out recording, and they made an actual musical of the story. It wasn't Roy Orbison. It was Johnny Cash, because Lance Guest played Johnny Cash.
Oh, very cool.
Nice.
Very nice. Now, I want to bring up to, and forgive me if I mispronounce it, but was it Dan O'Hurley playing Grig? Because that was my favorite character in the movie.
Dan O'Hurley, I want to say?
O'Hurley.
Yeah. Interstellar.
Can I throw a little shout out to the character that I know him best as? he was the president, CEO, in the movie. He was the man that Ronnie Cox's character was trying to eventually take out.
Yeah, he's the old man of OCP.
Yes, OCP. That's where I remember him from mostly, because RoboCop, that was one of those movies I just watched over and over and over again. But I just wanted to throw that out. But you're right. You're right, Kyle. He was a really cool character.
Well, one of the things I did like about him was the design of his look, that was an amazing makeup job. And I look back on that, and I always kind of look at his character, and I almost feel like they kind of used that for the base of the alien that Louis Gossett Jr. played in Enemy Mine.
Yeah.
And they just kind of took it to the next level.
Yeah, it was kind of like an Enemy Mine kind of Bosca thing going on there. I like that, yeah.
You know, it was interesting about the alien characters that you met, and especially Grig, because Grig didn't really know Alex from Adam. But he did understand that he passed Centauri's Excalibur tests, and the tests that actually qualified you for having the gift to pilot a Gunstar. So he trusted Alex to a point where he was vetted by the game. And that being said, he gave everything he possibly could surviving the attack on Star League Command from Zor in the Codan Armada. And gave everything he possibly could to make sure that Alex would succeed as the last starfighter. And I think that, again, if you want to draw parallels to a lot of the things that we've seen in the past, if you want to see, you would talk about your Obi-Wan Kenobis or your Yodas or any type of these mentor figures, your Mr. Miyagis, because Karate Kid Part, you know, it came out before. Mentor figures to our heroes, especially the heroes that have a lot of self-doubt, are supremely important to the narrative. And I think that's what Grig did. Especially since Centauri was waylaid earlier on, Grig was his confidence. He's like, you don't really have a choice here. You were given this talent for a reason, and you need to use it. You know, and I think that Daniel O'Hurley, he had such great gravitas about him, even being kind of like a comedic character, because sure, you don't really take him all that seriously because he was behind, you know, latex features, albeit that he could, you know, he could emote through them, but he was very much like that nagging conscience voice that made Alex think really deeply about his choices. What do you think, Dave?
Go ahead, Kevin.
No, I'm sorry. I want, you know, go ahead and go on that, because I want to go on to the next character, but I want you to answer that one, because that was a good point that Norm just said.
You know, I got to say, one of the best scenes I remember is when they're in the Gunstar and they're talking and deciding on what to do, and Grig shows him his family.
Yeah.
And Alex realizes that he's, you know, quote unquote, human as well, because he has a family. He's just like him. And he realizes he's not only doing it for the planet Earth, but he's also doing it for the family of Griggs, wherever his home planet is from.
I like how you brought that scene up, because that is an awesome scene, because I like how he is trying to describe his trailer park. It's in a, it's like, cause you know, Grig had talked about the caves that he lived in, and then, and Alex goes, well, I live in a cave that moves, but we never go anywhere, you know? Yeah. And, I want, you know, we have to talk about the lovely, we have to talk about Maggie Gordon, played by the lovely Catherine Mary Stewart. Isn't she just cute? I mean, I loved her in this film. I love her features, the way she smiles, and she's that perfect girl next door that you fall in love with, and that obviously, you know, has a relationship somewhat with Alex. But, you know, I remember her in Weekend at Bernie's, but this is probably the film that most people will associate her with. But she, one of the things I love about this film, and some of my favorite scenes, believe it or not, are the ones on the trailer park, because as you alluded to earlier, Norm, it's about telling a good story and having good characters, and you get a lot of that in these scenes, especially when you flash back to the, not flashback, when you go back and, you know, she's talking with the beta, and there's some comedic scenes there as well, but you really get a sense of the direction that Alex is being kind of torn in. You know, does he go away? Does he leave her? Do they go out together? You know, and so there's that kind of struggle that a lot of people feel, especially if they're getting ready to graduate high school and go to college and they're leaving their boyfriends or their girlfriends. Mm-hmm. But I mean, how do you guys feel about Catherine Mary Stewart's performance? I got to tell you, I had a little crush on her.
I'm going to say I had the same crush on her as well, because she just seemed like the perfect girl, not only for Alex, but for, you know, for any guy. I was like, hey, you know, she was willing to help him and do whatever, you know, she would run away from him, but she was also scared, because she was like, well, who's going to take care of Granny, you know, or what's going to do that? I mean, she wanted to be with him, but she was also very much into family, so to speak. Well, Kyle, what about you?
I know for me that one of the things that I liked about the character was you never saw the character get, I mean, you had all this craziness go on, and but you never see the character just get completely shaken. I mean, the one scene where she's talking, where he's explaining he's a beta unit to her, and he gets shot by a laser beam. I mean, and she just kind of rolls with it and ends up, you know, helping the beta unit save Alex by destroying the communication.
You know, the thing with Maggie is what makes her a great character, and I think that's a character type of archetype that you saw a lot in the 1980s. You know, you saw it with Elizabeth Shue's character in Karate Kid, and you saw it with, you know, Ferris Bueller's girlfriend, Sloane Peterson.
Sloane.
I think a lot of these women were, I wouldn't say that they were wallflower characters, because they actually had a certain kind of strength to them. I mean, Allie pushed Danny, you know, to go into the All Hill Valley Karate Tournament. Sloane was very much behind Ferris and all of Ferris's machinations. And in this case, Maggie, she was the force that grounded Alex's morality. You had Alex was a daydreamer. First and foremost, he wanted to leave the confines of his menial existence. But the only thing that really elevated him in that sense was Mags. And Alex found that opportunity to be able to go out there and do something better than the life that he was living. And Mags had that same opportunity, but she found that same type of crisis of faith because of how she was grounded, because she loved the trailer park. She loved Granny. She loved her life there. She loved being with Alex. She didn't really have anything. She didn't really have any ambitions past the trailer park, aside from maybe marrying Alex or becoming some significant portion of his life. But that's real, though. That's a certain real dynamic that happened, and it was something very archetypal about the female character role in the 80s. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong. I'm just saying that she wasn't weak as a character. She was very strong, but she was very strong in a very supportive kind of way, and I thought Catherine Mary Stewart was heartbreakingly amazing in this role. I mean, Elizabeth Shue was in that role, and Mia Sara was in these characters I was talking about. And you can go all the way down the pantheon of like all the, you know, the 80s actresses, you know, Molly Ringwald, Ellie Sheedy, you know,
Mia Sara,
right? But I think that Mags represented that, I get that tried and true phrase that behind every strong man is a strong woman. I really do think that Mags was the one that was able to ground him and give him that tether home, because every single time he did something, he had that, you know, like the pilots always put that picture on their dashboard of their girl. I'm going to come back to you. And that was Mags. He's like, I'm coming, Mags. And as soon as he looked at her, when he made that decision to go against the Cordon Armada, Mags looks up and she goes, I love you, Alex Rogan. And that's when the movie changes. That's when we get into that third act. And when the hero starts embracing his destiny and she's supporting him from millions, if not billions of miles away. And that's very human to this story. That's something that cannot be broken. The love is spanning literally parsecs of time. And you can't put a price on that kind of storytelling. That's something that I think is lost today. It's like you have this, you know, it's a very human-centric quality. And I think that's something that grounds us and why we are driven back to watching this movie, because it's still a fantasy. It's still, you want to see the good guy win and get the girl. And I think that's very prevalent in this movie.
Darn it, Norm, you're making me cry.
I mean, who can cry argue with cry. That?
I got a lot of passion for this movie. I'm sorry.
I love it.
Now, guys, we got to talk about the most important member of the cast.
Granny?
And that would be the gun star.
Yeah. Oh, the gun star.
Absolutely.
I mean, so, is this one of the more classic vehicles ever designed or what?
So in case anyone was wanting to know any trivia to the gun star, is that it was supposed to be based off the World War II bombers, where the starfighter himself would actually be the gunner and the navigator would actually just be the one flying it, but the one in charge is the gunner.
Yeah. All the way up there. No.
So what was your first impression of the Death Blossom?
Oh, Jesus. I don't think I have enough time for this. I mean, you know, let's extend this. Listeners, go get yourself a refreshment and buckle in for the second part of this, because we are not, usually we shave our shows for about an hour and a half, but this show is too important, and we don't get enough couch potato theaters during the course of a month, so we're going to go for it. We're going to go for it here. Let's look at, take a mental picture, if you will, of the most iconic ships that you have ever seen. Just the silhouette of those ships. The X-Wing Fighter, the TIE Fighter, the Millennium Falcon, the Death Star itself. And then you go to the other star genre. You have the Enterprise, yes? And then you have other ships that are in this, you know, the Star Destroyers. But now in 1984, you are introducing a new ship, a new silhouette, the Gunstar. How do you create something that doesn't embody or rip off or borrow too much from these classic ships that you have seen since 1977? I think the Gunstar itself, not so much as a great design, as much as I love the design, but it's what it stands for. It's the last starfighter. It's the last of this line of ships. And not only is it the last of the ships, it is a prototype ship. It's a prototype version of the Gunstars that we should have seen in action. So everything is on the line. You don't know if the Death Blossom is going to work. You don't know if the Gunstar is going to be able to do what it needs to do. But it doesn't matter because you're behind the heroes and you want to support what they're doing. And you just hope against hope that the little one guy is going to be able to defeat this giant empire. Right?
So, Kevin, what did you think of the Gunstar?
Oh, the Gunstar has a classic design. Now, you're going to think it's kind of silly, but one of the things that I remember, do you remember buying, I'm not sure what the attachment was. I don't know if it was on, you know, when you got the little lighter fluid things and they came with the little adapter, the little red adapter that had different little spouts depending on what your lighter fluid thing was. Or sometimes you would, you remember the little red caps that you would put in with a little like 8 to 10 round things, little round things. So it always reminded me of that because of the design, the way it was done. But it was such a unique design too. I mean, at the time too, I remember being, you know, still, you know, big, being a Battlestar Galactica fan of the Vipers and the Cylons, but this one had a very unique thing to it. And also it had a co-pilot seat that was, you know, prominent in the back. And but what was neat about this is that it showcased the two-man team that was vital for the ship to work. You had the pilot and then you had the gunner. And, you know, obviously that was important for a lot of historical real-life airplanes and vessels. But you didn't see a lot of that in science fiction. And the design, especially with the – and then you got the Death Blossom, which was like, you know, the weapon to use. But what was great about it was that all the other weapons on this ship were showcased. You know, you got the missiles and obviously the lasers. And so it was all showcased. It was one of those things like, you know, you're wondering what the Death Blossom is, but it wasn't, and you didn't know if it was going to work, but it wasn't needed until at the end when obviously they were able to set everyone up and do that. But it was just one of those ships that looked great. And, you know, when you look at the technology at the time that we used to create these special effects, for me, it still stands up. And it's so sad that there was not a toy version of this thing.
Oh, absolutely. I think, Norm, didn't you actually have a model of that? Or you actually showcased a model of that? You found a model somewhere?
I did. There are a couple actual real nice models of the Gunstar, like, out there on eBay. But I wish there was... I wish I had the time to put together an actual model, because there's a model kit out there that is fantastic. I think it's like a really expensive third-party independent model kit, and it's really nice, but, you know.
Now, here's something I'm gonna throw this idea out at you, Norman. I think it's going to blow your mind, especially.
Blow my mind.
We were talking about the arcades earlier. Do you remember the game Afterburner?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Do you remember the arcade set where you actually sat down and the whole thing rocked and moved and everything like that?
Oh, yeah.
Now take that and put a 360 bubble with the Starfighter game where you sit in the chair in the Gunstar as the gunner.
But that's what I'm talking about, man. That's what I'm talking about. You know, you had Afterburner, even the Star Wars game, it actually had its own chassis that actually moved. You know, yeah. Or you know, it's the sit-down X-Wing game that you played. You know, it had a giant cockpit. I mean, that's like where it really could have like just paid dividends and licenses, but and also it's not like it doesn't draw the inspiration from, you know, all of these things that we love, you know, especially like Top Gun. Afterburner came out after Top Gun because it completely capitalized on you know flying an F-14 Tomcat. But yeah, it would have been amazing to be able to do something like that for sure.
So, gentlemen, where does this movie stand in your personal fandom? Kyle, why don't you go first?
Oh, for me, this is one of those ones. I'm not going to necessarily put it in my top 10 all-time movies, but I have such a love for this movie that this is one of those movies until the day I leave this plane, I will always say, we need a fun movie to watch. You need something to get your sci-fi fix, put in The Last Starfighter. And it's a movie that just has that special place in your heart. You know, maybe it's not the best sci-fi movie ever, but there's so much magic in it that I dare somebody to tell me they didn't enjoy this movie.
Oh, absolutely. Kevin, what do you think?
This is one of those films that, I'll be honest with you, I kind of forgot about how much I liked it originally. Like I said, I had the VHS at one time, lost track of that. I don't remember if it broke or whatever, and just kind of left it alone for a while. 2000s, I think I remember seeing it on television, on broadcast television somewhere. And it was one of those films that I do remember liking, but I couldn't remember all the details of it. I remember the ship, of course, remember the Death Blossom, but the basic plot I kind of forgot about and kind of moved on. And it wasn't until recently when, you know, I reconnected with Norman through the podcasting that I'm like, you know what? I know he likes this film. There's got to be a reason. I like Norman, so there's got to be a reason why he likes it. And I went back and watched it, and I was like, okay, yeah, this is really cool. We got to do something with this. And then, of course, when we came up with the, you know, when Kyle originally came up with the idea for Couch Potato, and Norman naming the program as well, like, this has got to fit in there. And I did get familiarized probably within the last year or so, realized how fun this movie was. And I remember you popping in that that Blu-ray disc shortly after you received it from me, the signed copy. Mm-hmm. And I remember you're saying, man, this was just, I remember you were in bliss, just relaxing at home, watching this film in HD and remembering how important it was to you and how special it was for you.
It's one of those movies that is kind of like a mark in time. And and before we get too far down the road, because we're going to be touching on a couple of other topics here, I wanted to round out kind of like the lesser known part of the cast, because there are some pretty cool kind of like tie-ins that like pay a little bit more forward in fandom. One thing that people probably don't realize, because it was a cut scene, is that in Star Trek fandom, Will Wheaton played a character in this film. He was Alex Rogan had a younger brother, Lewis. And Lewis was this kind of like, you know, this, as Alec was the very reserved kind of, you know, I need to do good character. You know, Lewis was his ne'er-do-well brother who was a little bit more mischievous and stuff like that. He had a friend, and that friend was played by Will Wheaton, and that character was summarily cut from the film. And the Star Trek references continue, because Granny, oh, yeah, Mag's grandmother, was actually the main Talosian keeper in the pilot episode of Star Trek, The Cage. This wasn't Where No Man Has Gone Before. This wasn't The Man Trap that came out on September 8th of 1966. This was the very first episode, the very first pilot episode of Star Trek that featured Jeffrey Hunter and Maisel Barrett and Susan Oliver. Granny, who was played, let's see what we have here in the notes, played by Meg Wiley, was the actual Talosian lead character, lead Talosian alien, which was awesome. And the Star Trek references still continue, because
yes, please,
the Zandozan bounty hunter was played by none other than Mark Alamo, who played probably one of the most famous, notorious aliens in Deep Space Nine, Gul Dukat of the Cardassian Empire. So, yeah, right?
Yes, yes. You brought him up.
So you're crossing over literally the Next Generation, the original series, and Deep Space Nine all in the same movie, which is kind of awesome, right? Yeah. So there were a lot of great characters, like secondary characters, and we'll touch one on later, because I'm going to spend probably about an hour talking about Otis later on. But just in terms of how does this movie reflect, stand up? I don't have enough time to talk about this. I really don't. I really don't. It's one of those movies that is so deeply ingrained in my soul that I created my social media icon reflects the Starfighter logo. The t-shirt I'm wearing right now reflects the Starfighter logo. A custom ring that I had made reflects the Starfighter logo. Why do I love this movie so much? It's because this movie is about basically the characters. It's about humanity. It's about trying to find the best of yourself and how that projects into what you think you should be and the destiny that you're trying to reach. And I think that can be applied to Westerns, that can be applied to fantasy, that can be applied to cyberpunk, that can be applied to horror. It doesn't matter what genre you're in, because I think that the human race will always resonate with characters that are trying to be the better versions of themselves. That's why it connects so deeply. It doesn't matter the trappings of the movie. It matters the fact that the characters are solid and they're real and they identify with the people that they're talking to.
Oh, absolutely. Because just to take on how does it stand up to me is I'm like Kevin. I forgot about the movie for the longest time. And I went to Walmart one night after work. You know how you go to Walmart, you need groceries 24 hours. So I went over there, found it for $10, the Blu-ray and DVD.
And DVD?
And DVD. It was a combo pack.
Wow.
And I knew at that moment I had to buy it. And not only that, I had to go home and watch the movie. And I absolutely loved it. I mean, even though, yeah, it may not stand up to some of the special effects we see today, but you know what? It does pretty well. I mean, everyone needs that type of story. Everyone needs that type of encouragement. And you know what? I think that's what a lot of people sometimes are lacking, because they need to have that sense of direction in their life. And when they finally see, you know, that this could happen to them, or this could, you know, something great could actually come for them, but they have to take it by the horns, so to speak, and just run with it. And I guess that's why I've always, you know, thought this movie was an excellent movie, and I'm glad I was able to rekindle with it. So, gentlemen, would you like to see a sequel?
Well, before we get into that, Davis, I wanted to ask all of you something. It's really important, especially in the 1980s when it comes to cinema, because we had some great composers at the time. Obviously, you know, with the Star Wars movies, you know, we had the great John Williams, and in Star Trek we had Jerry Goldsmith, and we had I'm trying to like think of like every single person that like did a Star Trek soundtrack.
James Horner.
Thank you very much. And then there are all these great composers that were treating these scores and created such great emotional resonance with us. But I have to say that Craig Safin's score in this movie is probably one of the best soundtracks or scores I have ever listened to, because that whole like dun 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 dun, it has that great march and that great kind of like crescendo of the heart swell that makes you feel heroic. And what do you guys think about the soundtrack?
Oh no, absolutely, Norman. I mean, to this day, I can be sit back and that particular set of that music, that chorus there, just will pop into my head. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those things you hear and you just never forget it.
I mean, it
gets you going. It really does. It sets the tone. It sets the mood. It makes you feel, and what's nice too is that the music in this film, there's parts where the music is not in there, and that's one thing that a good composer can do. He can let the director know. Maybe the director has an idea of where he wants music, but sometimes a good composer will say, you know what, your actors are carrying this scene right here. It doesn't need music. And there's a good balance of that. And it's, you know, especially at the end with, you know, right before the death blossom, but you know, also back at the Starbright trailer park, there's some great scenes in there with some tension in the music. And you're right, Norman, the soundtrack and the score to this is just, it's phenomenal.
What do you think, Davis?
I have a quick question for Norman for you real quick though.
Yeah. Yeah.
In front of your house, you have one of those Starlight, Starbright trailer park signs, don't you?
Of course. I mean, who doesn't? We are in Southern California, right? And only like maybe about an hour and a half north of me is where the actual Starlight, Starbright set was that took place. So that's a bucket list item for me to watch. That and, you know, obviously Vasquez Hills, because Star Trek, you know. But composers, I mean, in all seriousness, composers, the right one, can really influence the emotional content of a story. You know, again, whether you have your John Williams, you have those smaller moments, or you have your James Horner, where you have these grander moments, or, you know, you have your Jerry Goldsmith, where you have these romantic moments. I mean, these are all composers that have been able to shape the narrative of the story along with the story itself. So, Davis, when you like listen to Craig Safin's soundtrack for here, what part of it really informs you of the key main theme and how it's manipulated to tell the story of the hero's journey?
I have to say, I always love listening to just the theme, you know, when it's dun da 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 dun da da dun da da da. You know, I mean, it's just, it gives you that like a positive sense that you're about to go on a adventure of a lifetime. And it is just an amazing soundtrack. I mean, I actually found it on Entrada. for like $19 in case anyone has not had that one, has that copy yet. But I mean, it's just such
a two disc set, right?
Yeah, it's the two disc set. And it's such a cool soundtrack because it's one of those that you could put into a car and drive and just go cruising or whatever and listen to it. And you don't have to say anything else.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So would we love to see a remake or a sequel? Norm.
Oh, I'm glad you're starting with Norm on this one.
Pass, go.
Okay, so let's see. We are about an hour into our show, so we have about... We have about 3 hours left. Okay, so first of all, before we get into this, because I've had this idea for a long time, Nick Castle, who directed this film, did an amazing job of being able to strike at the very heart what I think was very pivotal of the 80s, and that was the heart of the daydreaming teenager, especially after Star Wars, because Luke Skywalker's journey was about staring at his destiny but not understanding what it was. So when you actually have to take a look at this movie and see what Nick Castle was trying to get to, he actually told the hero's journey, the Joseph Campbell hero's journey, in a very succinct, very tight story about, A, not losing the thread of the humanity of the character, but having the character actually understand what it means to be this character, the weight and responsibility it means to be the starfighter and to bring about this new age of universal peace through defeating the Kodan Armada. Now, do I want to see a sequel or a remake? Well, in this age here, and I'm talking about 2016, I think that this movie has been so far removed from the public eye, and it's not necessarily was, you know, a hot button in the public eye in terms of a movie. I think that this movie would serve best right now as a reboot and not a sequel. Because I think that if you can stay true to what it means to be this daydreaming character that finds his destiny, I think that in today's day and age, it is probably more significant and more important in storytelling to tell you how to embrace your potential of becoming a hero rather than try and build upon the successes of the hero itself. And that's what a sequel would do. It would tell you what it was to be Alex Rogan as opposed to becoming Alex Rogan. And I think that becoming Alex Rogan is every young person's journey of trying to find the hero within themselves. That's what makes it so successful. You, as the character, that lost teenager who's 12 to 15 to 17 years old, I don't know what's going on, but you know what? There's the potential of that hero becoming me. Very much like a Green Lantern. The Green Lantern doesn't care about race, doesn't care about creed, doesn't care about religion, doesn't care about belief. It chooses the hero that's right for the job. And the Excalibur test that will be done either through MMO or through Oculus Rift or through VR or through some type of modern version of gaming, right? Because you have to appeal to the gamer of the time. That is the vehicle to be able to find that character that becomes the hero, then becomes the hero that doubts his or herself, and I stress herself because I would like to see a female hero, and becomes the hero or heroine that you want them to be. I think that's one thing that's missing from today's movies is the fact that you are not letting the character develop and embrace an audience in the way that the audience needs to latch in with that story. Everything is so spoon-fed right now in terms of this is what you need to see, this is what you need to know, this is what you need to feel. No, let the emotion of the story catapult you into the genre and let yourself fall in love with the hero or heroine that is telling you how to become the better person of yourself. I'm sorry, was that very preachy?
You're fine. Kyle, your turn.
I'm glad I didn't have to go next.
Your turn is coming, Raider Nerd. No, I actually agree with Norman. I think we're so far separated from this film that a reboot, I think, is the way to go. I think we, with the technology we have today, and what we are able to do, a reboot of this movie would be absolutely spectacular. And you know, I actually have a couple people in mind as far as casting guys. So yeah, let me bounce a couple ideas for you.
All right.
If you wanted to go for a male lead in the Alex Rogan role, what about Andrew Garfield?
I could see that.
I like it.
Yeah, I could see that.
I think any kind of fish out of water kind of type of character would be good.
Now, as far as playing Maggie, and it kind of popped into my head as we were talking about it, I'm actually going to take a Maggie from another show.
Mm.
How about Maggie from The Walking Dead?
I could see that. Yeah.
How old do you think? You know, how old do you think these characters should trend?
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking you could get away with maybe even maybe in that college, early college age.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, with Andrew Garfield and Lauren Cohen, they still kind of have that young enough look they can pull that off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
What about it? I know you like directors. Kyle, have you thought about what would, you know, be a good director for a remake?
Well, you could go a couple of different routes. If you wanted to go like a big name director, if you want to go to the Kremlin Company, I think The Last Starfighter by Joss Whedon would be amazing.
You see, as soon as I thought about rebooting, I thought that the person would be able to pull this off like just brilliantly would have been J.J. Abrams. This is his movie. Like more than Star Wars and more than Star Trek, this is his movie.
No,
yeah, I would have to agree.
I can agree with that. I mean, as well, you can never go wrong with J.J.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that he has that. There is like a really good balance of spectacle. I mean, he tried it with Star Trek, albeit to some degrees succeeded, to some degrees didn't. He tried it, obviously, with Star Wars and did really great job with it. But I think that in the realm of it, just could you imagine that giant space battle at the end between one Gunstar versus the Kodan Armada, the way that J.J. Abrams would film it?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Right?
That would be amazing.
I want to get in on this remake or you know, sequel here. I agree. Norm, your point on this being part of not in everyone's back of their brain and fandom. It's one of those films that people look back at. Oh, yeah, I remember that. I like that film. But it's not like your Star Wars or your Star Trek. Or recently, now that we've done an excellent job on Phantom Podcast Network's version of Megaforce. Now, everyone's mind is in Megaforce, of course. But yeah, it needs to be. It just definitely needs to be rebooted. But I kind of like to when you mentioned about seeing a lead in it, I would love to see a female lead in this. I think that would be great. And the woman that I think would absolutely fit right in there is Alicia Vikander.
Oh,
very nice.
Yes, she's made her name in Ex Machina, but she won an Oscar for, I think it was the Danish Girl? I think she was in that. I can't remember. She has an Oscar under her belt. And set in present day, and you know, just set in with like maybe a virtual reality type of video game or something, because you got to stick with the theme of the video game. I think two things you can't mess up with the remake of this. You cannot mess up the video game thing, especially where video games are now with virtual reality, you know, getting out there as well. And the leaps and bounds of technology with video games and how big a business that it is. You know, it would be great if there's a scene at E3 and she's there, you know, and there's something going on. And of course she's the girl and there's some, you know, there's some alpha male boys that aren't thinking that she can do it. And she just, you know,
smokes them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So you get that part, right? The other thing you cannot mess up in this movie is the ship. You got to get that ship down. And like what they did with the Battlestar Galactica reboot, they went back to the old Vipers. They didn't mess those up, and I like that. There's a little bit of streamlining going on, but I was happy with the way that they did that. So that's my take on that. I would love to see that. And I would love for them, you know, everyone's always in the mind frame of sequels. And I would love it if when they did develop this reboot, they did think about a sequel, because there are so many questions that I have at the end of this movie of what happened to our heroes and what became of, you know, the war itself. And of course you have to write in something at the end, you know, that it's not over, but there is a happy ending. There is a conclusion, but it would be nice to see what happens. What happens at the trailer park? Where is she living, by the way? Is she not living at trailer park this time? Let's say she's living in some low income housing somewhere, or maybe she's in college at a dorm. I mean, can you imagine her being taken away from the dorm and that her beta is taking her classes?
Exactly. Yeah.
By the way, you can find me on Twitter if you want some more script ideas. I've been thinking about this. So, but anyway, that's what I was thinking. I would love to see a female lead in this. This would just be great.
Yeah. Davis.
You know, I have to say, when I was doing the research for the notes of how the movie was actually going on, and I saw that there was a possible sequel in 2009, mm-hmm. that it could be talking about a grown-up Lewis Rogan, mm-hmm. or, you know, dealing with Alex and Maggie's daughter. And, you know, thinking about that, I'm going, if we're going to do The Last Starfighter, it needs to be a trilogy. Plain and simple. It needs to be laid out as a trilogy. The first movie can be Alex. Talk about how he becomes The Last Starfighter.
Or she.
Or she. But I thought about, I said, the second movie would be Alex training his daughter.
Possibly, yeah.
To be, you know, to take over for him. And then, you know, you go on. Because then if you have a trilogy built up, you then can do all the world building. You can find out all the different aliens, you know, understand why the frontier was built. Why is the Codon Armada
exactly
going to destroy everybody? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, who would make a perfect Grig? My cast right now would be John Billingsby.
Phlox. Enterprise.
Phlox.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that would be great.
Okay, so let's go around the horn here. I mean, let's take kind of like the secondary cast. Okay, let's look. Everyone has their shot right now. We did Alex, possibly, you know, and maybe Mags. But the great thing about Alex being a female is it could be male or female, which is awesome, right?
That's true.
But the two characters I think that really hold this whole story together would be Grig and Centauri. So, Kevin, let's have you thought about possibly casting Grig or Centauri? And if you did, who would they be? Same thing for Kyle, and same thing for you, Davis, and me.
Centauri, man, gosh, I kind of went to Mr. Archer himself. I thought about him. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name.
Scott Bakula.
Scott Bakula. Okay. I'm sorry, because I was looking back. He kind of has that look and that kind of charisma that I think that Centauri could do.
Little song and dance kind of guy.
Yeah, totally. You know, and he's got that smile. You know what I'm talking about? That Scott Bakula smile. Mm-hmm. There's just something about it. I could see him doing that. For Grig, man, of course everyone wants to, you know, jump to, you know, maybe Samuel Jackson or something like that, but I don't know. I haven't really put thought on that, but Scott Bakula is who I came to for Centauri. I could totally see him doing it, rocking that fedora. You have to have the fedora too. You have to have the fedora.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
I've got one for you for Centauri. Actually, I've got two possible suggestions in coming from totally different directions. Nathan Fillion as Centauri.
Wow. What? Yes.
I like it.
Yeah, that would be good.
Now, yeah. I'm going to throw another one out there. This is more for Norm, because I think it's very much out of the box, but I think this particular person could have a lot of fun with this role. How about Jonathan Frakes as Centauri?
I think Jonathan Frakes would be amazing as Centauri.
Yeah,
what?
Yeah.
And bring that Star Trek vibe to it. You know, the tie-in, yeah. Let's see. So for like, say, 30 years, I've been thinking about this. So,
By the way, real quick.
Yeah.
It would be kind of fun to have Mark Elimo back, maybe reprise.
Oh, as a Zandos Zan? Hell yeah!
So I had to, sorry to interrupt, but I had to throw that out there.
I think that All those suggestions are amazing. And I really do think like Nathan Fillion would be amazing in pretty much anything. But so when you think about Centauri, you're thinking about like song and dance guy, you're thinking about big name. And also you're thinking about like one of those legendary characters where people are like, okay, like I thought he was too old for acting, but he comes back in and brings it all back. I'm thinking for me personally, I'm thinking Christopher Walken is Centauri.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, he's legendary, but he's not really out there anymore. And for also, so kind of like, and this is something also for all the listeners out there, please email us or text us or Twitter us about who you think would be able to reprise these roles. But for Grig, I've thought about this a lot. I think that this is the right guy to do it. He has the right kind of flavor, the right snark. I think that Simon Pegg would be amazing as Grig.
Yeah, I can see that.
I can see that.
What about you, Davis?
What I was thinking for Centauri, I wanted to throw it out there, was Kevin Spacey.
Ooh. Oh.
And if you love House of Cards, you will get exactly what I mean.
But he also has that song and dance background, too.
Absolutely.
You know, that very theatrical background. Oh, damn, that's good. All right,
thank you.
I might have to sign up with that one. I think I'm going to lock that one. Kevin Spacey as Centauri. That would be pretty good.
That's awesome.
Well, Grig.
All right, Grig. I'm still going to go with John Billingsby. I think he would still. I mean, yeah, he may be a little bit older, but
that's okay.
I always thought you
know how old Grig is, right?
Yeah. So I always thought Grig was like a mentor himself. So I thought he worked perfectly with him.
Awesome. Okay.
All right, so what's our final thoughts, Kevin?
Man, Norman hit on the point that I get watching this is a trip down memory lane. There's certain movies that you think of, you remember where you were, maybe the theater that you were at, maybe the girl you had the crush on at the time that you went to the movie with. You know, just all these little things that you think of when you see these movies, because the 80s for us, let's face it, they're our wheelhouse when it comes to movies and entertainment. It was just a huge decade of wonderful filmmaking in a time and turbulent decade as well, you know. And when I look back on this film and also with the effects that it had, to me, even though you can tell that it's dated, it fits in the time so well. And I'll be honest with you, I would pay good money to see this on the big screen again. Like if this had a nice HD treatment re-release, that would be fantastic. But it's one of those things where this movie totally fits in the couch potato idea that we had. You're sitting down, this movie comes up, you're watching it, you know it's on your DVD or Blu-rays on the shelf, but you're not getting up, you're sitting it, you're stuck, you're there. And the commercials kind of come as the perfect time where like, okay, I'm going to go up, I'm going to make that sandwich, or I'm going to use the bathroom, or I'm going to go get that blanket and a couple more pillows and just sit and watch this thing. And you just get wrapped up into it. And that's what we did back in the 80s, you know, when we didn't have all the VHS and DVDs and streaming. When stuff came on television, that's what you did. You made time to watch these films. You looked forward. You looked in your TV guidebook for these movies. You know, the Saturday afternoons, the Friday nights, the Sunday afternoons, you know, there are these times that these movies came out. Not every one of us had the pay channels, too. So you had to, you know, watch these over. And if you did have a VHS, you recorded them. You recorded them with the commercials. Or maybe when you were good enough, you were able to time it correctly and record them without the commercials, you know. And you're laughing because you did this. You know, we know this. We all did this, you know.
Yeah.
And we had those VHS tapes that had, you know, those rough cuts. And that's, you know, and sometimes you put like, depending on what speed you recorded it, whether it was the EP, LP, or SP speed, you could fit a certain amount of movies on it, you know? Yes, I went there because that's what I did. I knew like – and I remember too, the movies that I liked the best, I would put on the slow speed.
SP.
SP, where they would take up the whole tape. Mm-hmm. If it was kind of like, you know, a couple of movies that maybe went together really well, I put them on the LP. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, you know what? I wanted a little movie marathon. I would put 6 movies on the EP speed, you know, and be – quality would be crappy, but who cares?
Oh, you win so much tonight, dude, for saying that. You win so much.
That's what we did. That's what I loved. And this is one of those movies that falls under that, you know. And it's a good time capsule. And that's what I get out of this movie.
Kyle, what about you?
Again, for this movie, this is one of those 8 movies, especially from that time period. It just screams fun. It's that Saturday afternoon matinee. You go get your popcorn. You sit back. You see it on the big screen, and you just have fun with it. It's got something for everybody across the board. You got the heartwarming. You got the family story. You got the love story. You've got the space action adventure. The sci-fi elements. You even got a little bit of they kind of keep you on the edge of your seat. I know there was a couple of things in there that kind of made people jump a couple times. The first time that they all think Alex is sick and they uncover the sheets and here's this glob that is the baby. But, you know, again, this is one of those movies too that, and I think it's something very much an aspect of the 80s. If you take this movie and put it in this time frame now, or even a time frame of 5 or 6 years ago, this movie is a certified blockbuster. Where with in the 80s, it was a solid hit at the time, but it just hits that cult status. And I think that's something we've lost a little bit in our current films. It's either got to be this huge successful blockbuster or it's garbage and there's no middle ground, except if you're falling in from like maybe an indie little independent film that could or something like that. And with it, when we were in the 80s, it was like it didn't matter if it was a blockbuster or a bomb. If you loved it, you loved it. And we've lost that element. And I think that's one of the things with Couch Potato Theater that I enjoy, is bringing back this, hey, you know, this may have not have been a great movie, but we love this movie and we're going to tell you why. And we hope that we inspire you to go out, watch this film, and you find these people like we do.
Norm, what do you think?
You know, I've actually said this many times about this film, and it's one thing I think that's worth repeating, is that when this film came out, what it represented was a different type of genre. It was the genre of the wholesome film. What I mean by that is that this film did not have to rely on sexism or extreme action or snarkiness or some type of catchphrase or some type of vehicle that just, you know, it preyed upon kind of like the social norms of the time. What this movie did do well, and I think this is why it really endures, is because it taps into the very natural cadence and rhythm of what it is to be human. And I think that is why we need to talk about more films like this. It doesn't matter if that is science fiction. Like I said, it could be set in completely different genre. What matters is that you care about the characters. You care about what they are doing, where they are going, the relationships that they have made, the challenges that have been put in front of them, the obstacles that they need to overcome, the heroism that needs to be connected to, and the ultimate resolution of their fate. That's storytelling. That's the way that stories resonate with humanity. That's why Star Wars is so successful, because you yourself can put yourself into the actual seat of the hero, of our protagonist, and become the parallel of his journey or her journey, like Rey or like Luke. You know, so we want to see what happens with Alex. We champion his cause. We want to make sure that he succeeds, and we believe in all of the decisions, because those are the decisions that we would make. He's not perfect. You know, he's not your quintessential prince in shining armor. He's just one of us. He wants to just to go to college. You know, he just wants to have a good relationship with his girlfriend. He wants to just kind of like get behind the stresses of like taking care of granny's cable or fixing an antenna or making sure that the trailer park is up and running. The only solace of his day is the thing that actually starts us on his journey, is that's playing a video game. That's the only comfort that he has. He's like, I'm good at this. I'm in control of this. This is what I like. It's realistic. You know, and that's the thing that I think that's missing from today's storytelling, is that you're not grounded in that sense of realism. You're not grounded in the sense that, hey, this could be me. The reason why we love Karate Kid, because Daniel LaRusso, He gets his ass kicked every day of the week. Who didn't? Right? But he has given this opportunity to be able to tap into something that's greater than himself and to embrace his destiny. I think that's something that it's very centrally human, that we are trying to aspire to be better than ourselves every single day of every single year of our lives, even if it's just incrementally better. And I think that's something that this story really taps into. So I don't think that I can heap on enough love for this movie, not just because it's a movie that I love from, you know, my childhood. It's because it's a movie that shaped my childhood. You know, it's a movie, it's a narrative that touches the very ley line of humanity itself. And that's just the aspiration to become something better. And I think that's something that is really sorely lacking in storytelling nowadays. So I can't love this movie enough. Obviously, you know, in my social media icon, what I wear and what I believe, it's all about that could be me. That opportunity to be able to take that chance, believe in myself, and to embrace my destiny could be me, as long as I believe it and grab onto it and trust the fact that this is what I am supposed to be. And I think that if we see more movies like that, I just think that everything would be just a little bit better. Call me naive, but I really do.
Well, who can really argue with that? I mean, that is an awesome story. All four of us have been saying how much we actually love this movie. And it is probably one of the best movies that I would say I've ever seen. I mean, I love it. I think the story's worthwhile. It has a happy ending. I mean, there's conflict, but still, like what Norm, Kyle, and Kevin have said, all of us could be a part of that. All of us could have that journey. And it's just a wonderful, absolute wonderful movie. So, the Phantom Podcast, current and future shows we have coming up. I don't know if anyone has been listening to Blood of Kings.
You should be.
Nobody.
Norm and Kevin have been doing an awesome job, especially with the last Big Finish audio of The Samurai. I just finished listening to that today. Really, really good show, gentlemen.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That was a fun one to do. It was a first foray into the audiobook media of Highlander.
Absolutely. And then we have what's coming up in the Fandom Flashback.
Well, I think Kevin's been hard at work at the Fandom Flashback.
Oh, yes. We are covering, it is the 30th anniversary of 1986. And we're going to be going back in time to all of the wonderful movies that came out that year. A lot of fandoms were created, like Highlander and Transformers and Robotech and Aliens, a lot of properties that we celebrate now and today. But there was just some other great movies that came out that year. A lot of blockbusters too, like Top Gun and Crocodile Dundee. And there was just a lot of good. There's also a lot of cult films that came out there as well. There's a lot of films, obviously, that were so bad they were good. I'm sure there's some films out there that were just bad. But it was
screw you. Howard the Duck is amazing. Screw you.
It is a good movie.
Hey, I'm not going to argue that one. I enjoyed Howard the Duck, but there was a lot of movies that came out that year, and the debate that we're going to discuss and talk about is whether or not this year, 1986, was possibly the best year in movies. And so we're going to be doing a four-part special. We're going to cover the first. We're going to do it in quarters, the first three months at a time, because it's fascinating to see when these movies came out, and whether they came out back to back or the same weekend, and what time of year they did was also interesting. But we're going to be taking you back in time as well, kind of little time travel. We're going to let you know what was happening with politics, what was popular in pop culture, music and sports, and it's going to be a fun ride. We're going to have a lot of fun doing that, and we're going to have some other guests on as well, and I'm going to make sure these yokels here that you're listening to are going to be on that as well. So,
All right.
That's right. I said yokels.
Tell me, doctor, where are we going this time?
It's all Tommy Wimey, wibbly wobbly, ladies and gentlemen.
Is this the 60s? Oh, 1999.
All right.
As we wrap up part one of The Last Starfighter, I guess we could say we could end it with a few things, but I'd like to end it with saying maybe there is a starfighter left.
Kevin? Up to your old Excalibur tricks again, eh, Centauri? Did it ever occur to you that it is against the law to recruit from worlds outside the Star League?
Kyle?
I must congratulate you on your virtuoso performance, my boy. Centauri is impressed. I've seen him come, I've seen him go, but you're the best, my boy. Dazzling! Light years ahead of the competition. Centauri's got a little proposition for you. Are you interested?
And Norm.
Things change. Always do. You'll get your chance. Important thing is, when it comes, you gotta grab with both hands and hold on tight.
Nailed it!
My favorite line in the movie.
Such a great line. Mm-hmm. Such a great line. So you can reach us at the Phantom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and even Google Play now. You can reach us also on Facebook at the Phantom Podcast Network. You can reach us by email at thephantompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We would love to hear your feedback on all of our shows, or in case you just want to just get to know us a little bit better. You can reach us at Twitter at Phantom Pod Network. Kevin, where can we reach you at on the Twitter?
At Spartan_Phoenix, and like Kyle, that's a little throwback to one of my favorite movies in the 90s, Demolition Man.
Tell them about the three seashells.
Oh, yes. If you don't know about the three seashells, well, I'm sorry. You just got to know.
That's right. You got to know.
Kyle, wait, real quick. Kyle had to step away. He is at A Kyle W.
All right. And Norm, where can we reach you at?
So, coincidentally, and also kind of in the spirit of why I love this movie so much, my Twitter handle is Starfighter1701.
And you could reach me on Twitter at Davis Grayson. Very simple, but it's always there. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the Couch Potato Theater. Remember, there's a reason why they created Dustbusters and remote controls.